This is Forum. I'm John Michaels, Public Affairs Radio Director, going to be talking with Dr. Adrian Hannis again. It's the third Sunday archaeology program coming up at August Annis today. We have with us from North Dakota, Michael McClovick, and Adrian, I'll have you introduce him because he's going to be talking about popular myths, archaeological facts, and we'll be talking about a lot of interesting things about the Midwest.
Well, thank you. I guess Mike has been someone that I've been off and on stumbling over for many years at the Plains conferences that we attend together, but he hails from back east in Pennsylvania and then did his graduate work in Illinois and has then been up at Morehead State for quite some number of decades, I guess, as they say in our business now. We put it in centuries or millennia or something. And so
I haven't been
still,
there that
you're still
long.
Under, you're still under centuries, so that's pretty good. In any case, we were really, I thought, fortunate to get Mike to come down, especially at this time of the year, with these kind of roads and so on, and to visit with us about a number of topics, but he's been looking at, I guess, for a number of years now, some of the different archaeological facts that come into the public view and then how some of these become modified and distorted from what might be the validity that we could come up with from the actual archaeological science as far as the investigations. So,
well, right. when we don't know about something, usually religion gets into it, and we develop myths and other ideas because we don't know anything about it. The Kensington Stone, I guess, is one of the things we're going to be talking about this afternoon at Augustana.
Yeah, the Kensington Stone is it's an issue around which I'm going to construct the presentation. But there are several ideas, and one of them you just touched on, as a matter of fact, and that is the idea of myth and the way people use it. In fact, one of the concepts that I guess I put to work in trying to communicate what I wish to talk about is a term called myth history. The term is actually one that was developed by historians because, as we all know, people have different ideas about history. And a lot of us, we think of history, in the old Henry Ford, history is bunk. And what do you need to know history for? But one of the things I found in teaching archaeology in Morehead was that while people often say history isn't important, if you say the wrong thing about history, they get very upset. And for example, as a teacher, I get student evaluations, and it's always interesting to read evaluations by students who were offended by something that was presented in class. Not that it was meant to be offensive, just that they right. didn't like the way history was coming across. And there are many scholars who have said that history is something that we do in the present time, and we take the past and we use it in order to communicate certain ideas in the present. In other words, history, even though it's about the past, is in another way really about the present. And so, I'm trying to investigate why people take objects sometimes that are not authentic, and there are many of them. And in fact, in the United States, we have a very robust tradition of fake artifacts, especially from the 19th century. But I'm not limiting it to that, because archaeological fakes are really a problem today. In fact, a lot of museum curators will tell you just about every major museum in this country has fake artifacts in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And isn't that true?
Oh, absolutely. And whenever I teach my museum classes, I try to make that point, because, and in a lot of circumstances, the types of fakes that are being produced, at least currently, would almost be totally impossible to identify as fakes unless you literally destroyed them in the process
in
of evaluating.
In order to find out.
No, I mean, a lot of the things coming out of Mesoamerica, for instance, statuary and so on, that were originally prehistorically made in molds, you know, the looters and so on have obtained the molds. The clays are the same clays. The pigments are the same pigments. Mm-hmm. So they're actually producing pieces out of the original molds, and then, but in the contemporary setting, and but passing them off is obviously being prehistoric. And so, it becomes a real conundrum for, and of course the antiquities market is ever increasing in scope and in value, so it becomes more tempting.
Yeah. Some people have said next to the illegal market in drugs, antiquities are the second big problem on the black market.
Well, and I think that one of the things that we keep hearing is that it's so bad that some of the, especially south, down into Mesoamerica and South America, a number of the drug cartels are actually involved in looting sites and selling antiquities, so right. They're even in that business.
Right, and if you can't get the real thing, you make a fake. One of Israel's foremost archaeologists, Israel Finkelstein, has said if an antiquity shows up that has not come from a well-documented archaeological dig, it's probably a fake, or we should at least assume that it's a fake. The issue I'd like to deal with goes beyond that, and the question is, why is it that some of these objects, which we cannot authenticate and which seem to be fakes, why is it that some of them become established and develop a following, and once an object has a following, once an antiquity is accepted by a group of people, it's very hard to convince them that it's not authentic. And there are a lot of different factors that come into play in establishing an object as authentic. You mentioned when you introduced this just a few minutes ago, you mentioned religion, and religion is one of the issues that is very important in subscribing to archaeological finds. Ethnicity is another one of the issues that becomes very important. Sometimes there are political considerations too. So archaeological objects and archaeological fakes can. Well, they take on a life of their own sometimes.
Well, like they say the winner of the war is the one who writes the history books.
And that's right.
If the other side wrote the history book, it'd be a lot different. Right downtown, we have a Native American store, and I asked them, I said, why don't you put your art up on the Internet? They said they used to do it, but it'd take about 3 to 5 days, and it would be, all of a sudden, that same art would appear out of China.
Hmm.
They would
really?
Copy it just from the picture.
Uh-huh.
On the Internet.
Yeah.
Or they'd find that painting in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
So they stopped putting the pictures of it up on the Internet. But getting back to the Kensington Stone, explain what that is and how that is something you kind of base your speech around.
Well, the Kensington Stone is a runic inscription that was found near Kensington, Minnesota, not far from Alexandria, in 1898. And the Kensington Stone, after it was discovered, the inscription on the stone was sent to a couple of language experts, people who knew Germanic languages. They said it was a fake. But about 10 years after the discovery, a historian from Wisconsin got wind of the stone, came up and looked at it, and his name was Hjalmar Holland, and he began promoting it. And he was very successful with promoting it. In fact, he was so successful, he wrote books and articles. I don't know how many. I think he has at least 7 books on the Kensington Runestone, probably dozens of articles. But anyway, by 1948, he was so successful in promoting the Kensington Stone that not only had he convinced the Minnesota Historical Society to endorse the Runestone in 1910, but by 1948, he got the Smithsonian Institution to provide a provisional endorsement and to exhibit it And I think that was about 66 years ago this month that the Kensington Moonstone went on exhibit in 1948 in the Smithsonian Institution. And Matthew Sterling, I think he was the chief of the Bureau of American Ethnology, he stated that this may be one of the most important artifacts in American history. And within a year of that, the entire argument began to fall apart as Swedish language experts started to look again at the runic inscription. And this followed in the 50s and 60s and 70s, a number of books and articles that came out that showed that the Kensington Stone was not authentic. But the story doesn't end there, because in the 1980s it started to the pendulum swung the other way and people started to argue that it was authentic. And most recently a book has been published called The Kensington Stone, Compelling New Evidence. I think this was around 2006. And so it's become so popular, and there have been so many enthusiastic advocates of the runestone's authenticity that the History Channel a few years back ran a two-hour special in which they not only argued that the Kensington Stone was authentic and a record of a Swedish-Norwegian expedition to Minnesota in the year 1362. By the way, that date is right on the stone. But that these Scandinavian explorers were accompanied by the Templars and by Cistercian monks as well. So it's a saga. It's quite a story, and it will. I think it will be. It's interesting to me to try to untangle the evidence about the authenticity of the artifact itself, and then to figure out why its popularity continues. No matter how many critiques of the authenticity come along, it always rises again from the ashes of that critique and to new levels of popularity.
Well, the Norwegians would never admit that the Swedes were here first. But why would they make the Kensington Stone back when they originally made it? Why did they do it?
Well, my argument is that the Kensington Stone is a fake, that it was probably a practical joke or a hoax of some kind. It was not done, by the way, with I don't think any serious bad intentions. But why did it was made in 1898? Why was it made? I think it was made as a joke. In fact, some of the individuals who were involved in making the runestone have been reported to have said that they wanted to make something that would puzzle the minds of the educated people. And I think they accomplished that.
Well, yeah, when I was in Israel, you can always buy a piece of the cross.
Of course.
If you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Relics. There's a desire, I think, for people to own something that they can hold in their hand or be part of their collection or, you know, paintings, I guess, or that type of thing. We see so much coming out of, like, China now.
There's also a desire, I think, by communities to have something special that sets mm-hmm. them apart. And the Kensington Stone sets apart a couple of communities in west central Minnesota. Alexandria is where the Kensington Runestone is housed now at the Runestone Museum, and I think you can visit it there and see the stone in its a plexiglass case or its glass case. It has been a tourist attraction, and it's been a tourist attraction, and it has been promoted by the local communities. Boy, since the 1920s.
Well, Adrian, you're working on the site in Mitchell. And it's almost like CSI. You have to have a chain of evidence to document a find nowadays.
Well, you do, but I mean, it's interesting because the period in which this stone appeared, that you were, you know, the Kensington Stone at the turn of the last century, there was a whole plethora of discoveries. The Piltdown hoax, which was part of our evolutionary sequence, you know, held sway for quite a long time, and finally only with testing that didn't exist to begin with, or the suspicion that there was something wrong with the specimen, you know, finally came out. And there are people I mean, it is interesting because there are people that come in to our office over there frequently with artifacts or what they believe to be artifacts. And the reaction of the different folks is in itself kind of, I mean, one could get very intrigued just with that part of this exercise, because when we say, well, we're sorry, but this really isn't, a shaped object by some human prehistoric group, but it's actually a naturally shaped piece. Some people accept that without, you know, any particular difficulty, but there are others that have already in their mind, and probably in some instances have even shown the piece to others before they've brought it over. And, you know, it becomes cumbersome then to say, well, it isn't, because it sets up a situation in some cases where I suppose people become embarrassed sometimes, but, you know, so these exercises, I mean, we go to extraordinary levels to document as from as many different lines of evidence, as you say, as we can, the finds that we are working with. And what you said earlier, Mike, about, several comments that anymore, if one doesn't practically excavate the individual specimen themselves, you become somewhat loath to say that you want to endorse it, because there's just, for all kinds of reasons, there are all kinds of things being, I think in some cases there's moments in time where tricking the academic community has been an interesting pastime for folks, you know, that we should put these people on, you know, the hot seat and say, well, is this really X or Y or something? And you're sort of standing there thinking, why did I come to the office today or something? But
the first dig that I did at Morehead State up by the Canadian border, one morning we came to our excavations and in the bottom of the units, which we had cleaned out the night before, there were bones all over the floor of the excavations, and they were pig bones. And somebody came during the night and put pig bones there, and I'm sure it was stump the archaeologist time. And of course, we could tell right away that these weren't natural. But
well, a lot of, you know, if you travel through Wisconsin, especially, there's a lot of Viking artifacts, but probably 90% of them were found by Swedish or Norwegian cultures, I guess you might say.
Right, right.
They're not found by, you know, Sudanese.
Well, I would say more than 90% of them, because the Kensington Stone and these and a number of other artifacts that I'll be talking about later on today, they have all been used to argue that the Scandinavian explorers came here during the Middle Ages. But my gosh, when we go out and excavate sites, and I think Adrian could confirm this, we've dug sites all over the Dakotas and Minnesota, and we don't find medieval European sites here. We just, the pottery, the kind of trash that you would find, the metal debris.
Not at all. No, I mean, not at all. And we've worked as far over as Michigan to the east, so we've certainly worked in Minnesota and Wisconsin and so on. And again, I can't speak to anything even further to the east coast, but it's...
Where are the archaeological sites? I mean, the actual sites with features and house foundations and middens with European debris in them. We find an American Indian sites, and they're all over. Mm-hmm. And they date from thousands of years ago to hundreds of years ago to right up to, the historical period and, right up to today, literally. But where are these medieval sites that would go with the inscriptions and the axe heads and the halberds and the Viking swords that people occasionally find? We don't find the sites.
Well, the Templars were supposed to go to New York. That's the current story. But then again, there's a lot of alligators in the sewers in New York too.
Yeah,
right. People love to have a good story, though. They like to have a myth, especially if it's of their religion, of their ethnic background. They like something that will support that. So there's kind of a general leaning or desire to be in that, to accept that fact.
Yes,
it does become though unfortunate that some of these things go beyond a good joke or a good hoax and become the basis for really bitter and even worse violent confrontations, you know, between groups. And it's a shame that, you know, our discipline, like others, gets caught in the middle of some of these frays, you know, where we're being called upon to give some testimony that this has authenticity or it doesn't, but
yeah, you use the word bitter debates, Adrian, and that goes back to something that I think is really important. People really care about history because, you know, history is part of our identity. It's who we are as a society, and a lot of people don't like the idea that history is in the hands of academic people and scholars who go and get PhDs, and it makes them think that we can define the history, or to put it in other terms, the identity of people just because we have a degree in something like archaeology or history.
Anyone writing a book today, of course, wants to sell books.
And that's another aspect of
it. So they develop a buzz about it. Now, the Kensington Stone, that, you know, Alexandria, Minnesota, isn't that far from Sioux Falls. Are there other myths in the Upper Plains that that we're starting to hear about?
Well, do you mean other finds?
Other myths about history that, I mean, Buffalo Bill Cody would probably have a few, you know.
Pardon me?
Wild Buffalo Bill Cody probably had a few, you know, stories, you know. But as Barnum and Bailey said, there's a sucker born every minute.
Well, in the 19th century, there was a very popular myth about the mound builders, about a lost race of people who were here and constructed mounds all over the Midwest, from Ohio and Tennessee and Kentucky into Illinois and Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota and even in the eastern Dakotas.
You got some in Sioux Falls.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that business is not finished yet. There are still people pursuing that, and there is even a magazine devoted to promoting those ideas, and you can find it on bookshelves in bookstores today.
Well, what are the mound people?
The American Indians built the mounds. They built the mounds starting thousands of years ago. In fact, down in Louisiana, there are mounds that I guess you could say, in a way, predate the mound builder, or at least the climax of mound building cultures that was 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 600 years ago. Mounds were still being built by American Indians in the historic period, and there are European travelers and explorers who describe people building mounds and using mounds in the Southeast. But that notion continues today. This notion of the Vikings or the Scandinavians in the mid-continent of America, that extends into South Dakota. There are people who are arguing that you have sites in northeastern South Dakota related to the Scandinavian exploration of this area. It extends into the eastern North Dakota area. Another popular idea that was promoted by a man who had affiliations at Harvard University, Barry Fell, he argued that there were megalithic European peoples in America leaving Libyan and I guess you would say Phoenician-type inscriptions and Celtic inscriptions in eastern North America and all the way into the Midwest. Into the area around eastern Iowa thousands of years ago. That story is still current, and those ideas still circulate, although they're not as popular today as they were in the 1980s and 1990s.
Now, they used to have chakras, as they called them, were, you know, Madison, South Dakota, they'd have train loads of people coming out to these big tent. Mark Twain would come out and speak at him. So back then, people didn't have the internet, or, you know, they kind of believed people, I guess, when they saw it, went to a chakra, as they called it back then, whatever. But getting back to the myths, I guess, you know, the Kensington Stone, is that ever going to be disproved then?
Scholars are satisfied today, at least most of the runic authorities and historians and archaeologists that I know of reject the authenticity of the runestone, but that doesn't carry a lot of weight with the advocates of the runestone who claim that it's authentic.
And the people who still believe in the mound people, they say it's not the Native American?
Some of them, yes.
If it's not the Native American, what do they think it is?
Well, people from the old world. In fact, in the 19th century, the popular idea was that it could have been, somebody like the Mongols, perhaps, came to the Americas, or perhaps a group of Hindus came to America. More popular was the notion that they might have been built by the lost tribes of Israel. Others thought that maybe North Europeans came to America, because building mounds was something that was done in Northern Europe as well in the during the Iron Age. So perhaps Iron Age Europeans came. Others thought that maybe the mounds were built by some of the civilized, quote-unquote, peoples from Mexico, like the Toltecs, perhaps. So there were many ideas about who built the mounds. Archaeologists today are satisfied that the American Indians, the North American Indians, or their ancestors built the mounds.
They were mainly burial mounds, weren't they?
Many of them were burial mounds. Some of them were you might say, substructures for temples that were placed on top of them, some of the later
mounds. Well, you know, we had that whole spate. I mean, it continues, too, very actively today of the Von Daniken particularly successfully promoted the idea of aliens creating these structures. And I know there are a number of programs on TV probably every week or two that deal with, you know, this. And again,
ancient aliens. That's
yeah,
right.
And so it's and of course, I keep trying to promote the idea that all of these things, especially the idea of aliens from other, you know, galaxies or something, is a very demeaning thing to say about the people who were actually the ones who constructed them, who were obviously the ancestral people that were on the ground, whether it's in the old world or the new world, and that, you know, the arguments that are advanced are things like, well, you couldn't construct this. It would have to be seen from above, like, for instance, the Nazca lines that are out across the vastness of the plains to the south. And, well, you can conceptualize it. You don't have to see it.
Well,
build it, even if you can't get above it and look at it when you finish it, you know. So.
Our time's running out, but the more we know, the more we find out we don't know. And if you don't know something, people have to try to put some explanation to it. But that's where they can come and hear your topic at Augustana this afternoon, Michael McClovic. Thanks for coming down from North Dakota and being part of our program, too. It's going to be at the Gilbert Science Center. It's free, open to the public. Adrian, tell us where they go and what time it's going to be today.
Well, it's at 2 this afternoon, and it's in the room 100, which is the auditorium in the north end of the Gilbert Science Center. And the Gilbert Science Center is at 33rd and Summit. So, and it's absolutely open to the public, and there will be some refreshments available, and so we'll have a interesting discussion, I believe.
And Michael McClovic, for those who want to be an archaeologist, what do you suggest to them if they're in high school right now?
They should read, and then pick a school to study at where you have an active program for undergraduates.
And Augustana is one of those.
And Augustana is one of them.
Dr. Adrian Hanniston, Michael McClovic, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Forum.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.